This Cup of Earl Grey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad, and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints featuring original illustrations by Toba Ushi.
This is Houston Huddleston from New Starship, and I'm restoring the Enterprise D bridge, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Tea, Earl Grey, hot.
It's time for another serving of Earl Grey, our dedicated TNG show. I'm Philip Gilfus, sitting in the center chair this week. I'm joined by my co-host, Daniel Prue, who is currently serving drinks in 10 forward and dispensing bits of wisdom and advice to crew members. What's going on, Daniel?
Not a whole lot. I'm just a listener, so I'm just down here, you know, listening to everything that's going on, making sure that everything's good. If somebody's having a bad day, I'm going to talk to them and make them feel better. But, you know, it's pretty standard down here.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Daniel. Your hat was making a whole lot of noise there.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Let me change this hat out for another equally ridiculous hat.
Okay, well, that makes sense. I'm also joined by my co-host, Darren Moser, who is currently holding a debate about the Prime Directive in his quarters. How goes the argument,
Darren?
The
first duty is to the truth, be it historical truth, memorial truth, categorical truth. Hey, Philip, I didn't see you. You didn't use the little door chime. I didn't see you come in. I'm doing good. It's just me in the mirror right now. But I feel really confident that once the symposium gets here, that from Cygnus 4, that I'll be ready.
Well, when it's time to find the enemy, all you have to do is look at the man in the mirror. Oh yeah.
So, are you suggesting, just out of curiosity, that Picard literally practices these speeches in the mirror, like hoping that one day he'll find like a reason to use them or an excuse?
Let's just ask Livingston, because I'm sure he's witnessed many a practice.
You know, he's asking Livingston to read his speeches for him. Just holding the pad up to the fishbowl.
What do you think, Livingston?
Bloop, bloop, bloop. That
Picard
bad, huh?
Blog. It's called Four Lights.
I only see... Never mind. Well, anyway, I want to welcome our listeners. As you probably cannot tell from our introductory chatter, here at Earl Grey, you know, we often talk about the technical aspects of The Next Generation. You know, our critique of episodes, stories about the production of the series, and which characters we like. But to me, TNG is more than any of those individual elements. I mean, I never lose sight that The Next Generation and Star Trek as a whole is a futuristic storytelling of the future of humanity. And so this episode of Earl Grey, we're going to focus on that vision or that philosophy, or that depiction of utopia, whatever it is you want to call it. And so I'm just kind of going to go start with some opening thoughts from the three hosts here, to include me, and I'm going to start off briefly about, you know, why it's important to me about this kind of topic. Because, I mean, I think we've talked about in the past about, you know, why do we like TNG and Star Trek and what draws us. And to me, that vision and that philosophy, whatever word we want to use, is what draws me to Star Trek, particularly Star Trek The Next Generation. And so to me, that's why I watch. That's what gets me every show. You know, what's the lesson? What's the morality? What's the moral conflict, or what are we being shown about our possibilities? And I think that's important to, of course, you know, as a whole, to society and the world and all that stuff. You know, we know all about the stories of the original series and the issues it breached in the 60s, and The Next Generation, I think personally brings it to a different level, but we'll talk about it. And so that's kind of why this is so important to me. But, you know, maybe that's just me. So, Daniel, we'll start with you. You know, what do you think about this whole issue? Am I just going crazy here? Or do you think this is something that's important to you about The Next Generation?
No, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly. the reason that I'm drawn to TNG, the reason that I think it's the best show, is because I think it's, in a lot of ways, it's the peak of the Star Trek vision of the future. You know, we get the three seasons of the original series, and it does a lot of really impressive, really amazing things for television in the 60s. But it didn't get to grow the same way that TNG did. And, the thing I love the most about, if you want to call it the philosophy of TNG or Star Trek in general, is the optimism. That's definitely what draws me to it. So, and I'm not going to, blow anyone's socks off by saying things people haven't heard before. But that's the most impressive thing. We're all big sci-fi fans, and you can count the number of positive futuristic sci-fi, on one hand, generally speaking. You know what I mean? Like it's usually dystopian. Even if it's not dystopian, it's pretty. This is just humans as they are in the future. Very rarely do we get science fiction where humanity has overcome its problems, where it's become better. And Star Trek does that, and that's, I think, the base goal of Star Trek, and I think TNG does it best.
All right, good. What about you, Darren? Are you on board on this happy train, or do you have any other thoughts?
No, I definitely concur. I feel one of the aspects of TNG in the philosophy department is almost its timelessness. Not that every aspect or every topic they approached, has the same weight, but there are definitely many where even today it almost has a more resonance than it did, in the late 80s when it was written. I think of the speech Captain Picard gave in The Drumhead, where he's speaking about, the first link of the chain being forged, the first speech censored, the first thought forbidden, the first freedom denied changed us all irrevocably. The first time any man's freedom is trodden on, we're all damaged. And just those words, so wonderfully written and so eloquently delivered by Patrick Stewart, they resonate with many of the issues we're dealing with today in, the latter half of the 20th century, where many Star Trek people like to time travel to. But that's what I really enjoy most about that aspect of Star Trek, especially in TNG, is almost the timeless factor of the morality plays and the philosophy.
And also, since we're talking about the vision and philosophy, Darren, I do want to correct you that it is, of course, Sir Patrick Stewart.
Oh, yes, Stewart. Sir
Patrick. Not go to knighthood school to be called Mr. Patrick Stewart. Or professor. it's something different.
He has lots of titles.
No, but I agree, Darren, what you said and what Daniel said. Obviously, and again, this is sort of preaching to the choir, anyone who is familiar with Star Trek, which hopefully you are listening to the show, about the ability for Star Trek to take modern issues, it doesn't matter whether it was the 60s or the 80s or the 90s or the 2000s, and kind of create this futuristic debate, like you talk about in The Drumhead, but make it relevant. I mean, here we are in 2013, and some would say the speech you just quoted from Drumhead may be very, applicable to today. But for our first kind of subtopic here, what I wanted to talk about with y'all was the quote-unquote Roddenberry vision. And, when I say that phrase, Daniel may think of something, and Darren may think of something, and our listeners may think of something. So I'm going to attempt to give it a definition, and you can agree or disagree, and we can talk about it. So to me, when I think Roddenberry vision, Gene Roddenberry, of course, created Star Trek and the original series in the 60s, but I don't define it as one man. Like, I don't think, okay, this is what just Gene thought, and then that's it. I mean, to me, it's something a little bit bigger than that. All the various people behind Star Trek, whether it's TOS or TNG and beyond, and I don't have the encyclopedia knowledge, Bob Justman and even Rick Berman, when he continued on with Roddenberry as the exec producer of TNG and beyond, whoever, but at least I'm going to attempt a definition. Like I said, you can agree or disagree, but basically it's that in the future, humanity will have evolved over the need for conflict among ourselves, the need for money and possessions, and will unite to abolish disease and poverty and to seek out exploration to the final frontier, and we'll seek to better ourselves. And to me, kind of the best definition, I'm kind of stealing this, paraphrasing it, is Captain Picard, or excuse me, Commander Riker, what he says during First Contact, Star Trek First Contact, and Deanna Troi and Geordi when they're explaining to Zefram Cochran about, you know, this is what's going to happen. And to me, that's kind of, to me, the Roddenberry vision. And I know, you know, some people hold that up as the ideal, and like, I don't know Gene, I can't say, oh, this is what Gene said, and, you know, but it's something that I certainly am a fan of and believe, but I know other fans are like, you know what, that's great and that's good, but I don't think that's 100% what makes Star Trek. And I think there's other ways to do it. You know, I think there's maybe a somewhat debate of like TNG versus DS9 and Roddenberry vision, no Roddenberry vision and conflict. What's that all mean? But anyway, let's just talk about it. So Daniel, what do you think about this Roddenberry vision? You know, do you agree with it? Is it, you know, vital to Star Trek, or is there room for exceptions, or what do you think about this?
As your definition that you stated there, like kind of as like a mission statement for Star Trek, I totally agree with this. And I think, you know, I guess if we were to bring up Deep Space Nine, a lot of people would say that quote unquote deviates from the Roddenberry vision the most. But I still think that even Deep Space Nine follows the definition that you just gave. I do. Ultimately, I think that show, along with every other Star Trek show, does show a future in which humanity has overcome and continues to overcome and still is working towards overcoming any issues that we encounter. This isn't obviously not the Roddenberry podcast, but this is the Roddenberry part of the podcast and I've made no secret about it. I don't think he clearly is a better world builder than like script writer or do you know what I'm saying? Like his vision, quote unquote vision, I don't know if that's what it was, but his ideas or whatever we think of as Roddenberry was brilliant. Clearly, I mean, we wouldn't be talking about a 48-year-old television show right now if it wasn't. You know, whether or not he was very good at the day-to-day stuff may or may not be true or whatever, but I appreciate that influence that it, especially on TNG specifically, that it had. And I think any future Star Trek, and I think this is a big problem that people have with the Abrams stuff, is that it doesn't reflect that, or they feel like it doesn't reflect that kind of the mantra that you just laid out for us from Roddenberry. They don't feel like they think maybe a lot of criticism is that it's just a generic sci-fi thing, and that it doesn't differentiate, it doesn't show optimism in the same way that the 60s series did, or, you know, TNG did, or whatever. But I do think that going forward, yeah, I mean, it's tough to do, but if you do it right, I think that's the best way to do it for sure.
And again, this is just my point of view, because I don't want to say like, oh, this is the point of view, this is what fans think. I don't know. This is what I think, and you can take it or leave it. But I always feel like the rule, whether it was written or unwritten, because, you know, Gene ultimately, at least the first two seasons, at least, you know, edited everything. And, you know, not just because we talked with them last week, but, you know, Standard Orbit has done some good episodes. If listeners want to listen to Standard Orbit after you've listened to Earl Grey, they've talked about, you know, these are the Voyages book about, you know, what was going on behind the scenes with season one. But to me, like, the sort of credo was, look, Starfleet officers aren't going to argue among themselves, because that's, you know, the conflict isn't there anymore. All conflict comes from outside. It comes from alien encounters. Like, that's TOS. You know, we don't want to see, which we did, but I'm just giving, you know, we don't want to see bigotry among Starfleet. That we did. We saw it with the Balance of Terror, because we had the guy who was prejudiced against Spock because he looked like a Romulan. But generally speaking, you know, they're not doing bad things. Starfleet people are. And, you know, you take this to TNG, and that's kind of the same, right? Same thing. All conflict comes from the outside, from aliens. And again, generally speaking, I'm sure we can think of exceptions. But I think DS9, you know, and Daniel and I have had these arguments in the Arboretum about, you know, what's going on there. But I agree with you, Daniel, that to me, DS9 does have more conflict, quote unquote. I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, but anyway, at least the perception and or reality of more conflict. But it does come from aliens. You know, it's not necessarily, you know, Sisko arguing with Bashir. I mean, they do argue, but you know what I'm talking about. They're not like bad people. But you do have other alien species coming in, bringing perhaps different points of view, and that's the conflict. But it's not, you know, humans necessarily conflict among themselves until you get to episodes like, and you're going to be better at episode titles than me, the defense of AR.
Oh, AR.
The siege of AR, like 3-2-7 or something.
That's weird.
Right. Right. And, you know, this isn't the orb. We're not going to talk DS9. But
they have
know,
names,
an episode
Philip.
Where, yeah, well, I suppose. yeah, I just see numbers. I'm kidding. But so, I mean, that would be a different episode. But Darren, what do you think about all this? The Roddenberry vision? What's going on here?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you that the Roddenberry philosophy is become more than just one man. It is a combination of everyone who has had an impact on TNG and Star Trek and added their piece to it. But I think of two episodes where that vision is kind of spelled out specifically. First is the neutral zone, where you have the frozen, you know, humans from the past, and they're like, they don't quite get the fact that there's no money, or like the one character wants to see his stock portfolio because he's sure it's going
to
be.
I want to talk to my
really
lawyer.
High. It's like, oh yeah, we've gotten rid of lawyers by now. Don't worry. No, but you know, that is a great one where they're, you know, they are really us. And it's like, how would we react if all of a sudden we're plunged into this world where it's not just, it's a great future and everything's push button and we have nothing for want, but how do you know what to do? How do you know what to do on a daily basis in a world that it would take a couple hundred years for us to change to that? And another great episode, a classic, would be Time Zero 2, where our favorite literary author is transported back to the future and realizes that it's worth a couple of cigars over the betterment of humanity.
No, and I know Daniel's laughing about the episode, but I agree with you, Darren, because that's actually a good, and I don't know off the top of my head, I'm in my rewatch here, so I'm sure I'll hit it here eventually. But I mean, it's true because, you know, this whole like, you're telling, I am going to try to do this, you're telling me that there's no more poverty and disease, and you're going to tell me you just don't do that anymore? And Deanna's like, yeah. Oh. You know, and his cigar wilts in his hand. No, I don't know. You know, but I mean, I, you know,
I think,
regardless
I think
of time
or
opinion.
Is, you know, I come from a time when men, you know, fortunes are gained and lost built upon the backs of other men. And you're telling me it's not that anymore. And then she's just like, nope. And yeah, it's the greatest reaction, you know, of him to be like, oh, well, I never really felt that could be a possibility.
And then Daniel's trying to log off because he's like, I'm not part of any episode where Time's Arrow is a point of view for anything.
Coming up next week, we review Time's Arrow, part 1 and 2, and a double part, super long episode.
On why it's the best episode in TNG and encompasses all the values.
Boy. But that's the thing. I mean, you guys are right. I mean, of course, I'll never say that there's nothing good about any TNG episode. Of course, there's always something that you can enjoy or you know.
Justice!
yeah, that's true. But, so, yeah, I mean, it is good philosophy, and it's just, you know, why. I guess I'm just sitting here thinking, and it's like, what do we compare Star Trek to? I mean, it's not, you can't say like Star Trek is like Star Wars. You can't say Star Trek is like there isn't, it's not like Doctor Who. It exists in like a universe in a category by itself. And I think that is the strength of what we would call the quote unquote Roddenberry vision.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the fact that, one, it's not dystopian. I mean, a lot of sci-fi nowadays thrives on dystopian view, which is a great way to take sci-fi, but it's, you know, you can kind of only take so much of that before you just want to watch something happy.
Building explodes. Explosion happens.
But on top of that, I think that one of the things I've always enjoyed most about Star Trek, actually probably the most, the quality most that resonates with me, is the fact that it's our future, is how it's set. Is it's, this is not a galaxy far, far away. This is not an alternate dimension. This isn't an alien planet. This is Earth. where we went through several world wars, where we have nations that rose and fell, where we had issues of poverty and struggle and strife, and we overcame it. And while if that to be an actuality is another story, but to have that as a vision and something to aspire to, because many of the things that are most worth inspiring towards aren't necessarily things you're going to reach, but the act of moving towards them is in themselves, you know, worthy of the act.
And you know, we're all very enthusiastic and optimistic about it, but let's sort of acknowledge the critiques out there. Because, like, I mean, like, I like TNG, and I love it, and I'm repeating myself probably, you know, for the morality plays, and, like, to me, it's especially watching this as a 10-year-old, you know, hey, this is how you're supposed to live your life. And, you know, I was like, yes, that's awesome. That's, I mean, it's very inspirational and aspirational. And so, you know, maybe if you're a 20, 30, 40, 50, 60-year-old, you're like, I don't really need a role model. I'm good, and I'm just watching for entertainment. But my question is this. Look, the critique, as we all know, of the next generation is like, you know, everyone's perfect, you know, all this stuff. There's no conflict. And so let me throw this out. Do you think the Roddenberry vision, again, however I defined it or however you think it is, do you think it's a straitjacket to the next generation? Or, as I like to think, or do you think, like, that's the whole purpose of the show? And, I mean, if you don't like it, then, you know, you probably don't like Next Generation. I can't force you to like it.
I think it's not a straitjacket, and I don't think that the characters themselves are perfect. I feel like it's more that like we say, the driving force has changed. Like, the core value of the society has changed. Still, they're human. Still, they make mistakes. Still, they value the Federation and, you know, will eventually place that above other races in a time of war. You know, those are all still very human things. And if TNG loves to delve into what it is to be human, and I think that in itself does cause lots of conflict, it's just the small interpersonal, I think, that was really what was capped in Roddenberry's direct oversight. But the overall driving force, I think, wasn't capped, I believe. I think it was more just a substitution of what drives us today.
And I will say that I don't think it's the philosophy that straitjacketed TNG, if that's what you want to call it. Which that's what you're saying, that people are criticizing it for, and I do agree. I hear that quite a bit. And I don't think it's the philosophy that did that. I think it was whoever decided that should be a rule. I guess it was Gene, but even after he died, we still got it for the rest of the series. Like, I guess that's where it ends for me. Like, where the vision ends and his control begins is when he says you can't have any conflict, any inter-crew conflict, which makes zero sense to me. And I would have been okay with more of that in TNG. So if it did straitjacket TNG, I would say that it's not the philosophy that does it. It was the writers and the showrunners that decided, okay, because Gene felt this way, or because whoever decided that this is the way we should go, then we should go that way. That's what straitjacketed. But I don't think that's inherent in the philosophy of Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, if anyone who knows Rick Berman is listening, we would love to have him. because I don't do production and backstories and all that stuff. I just TNG and Star Trek. I just love the story and the world that it inhabits. So I'm not an expert on what went on behind the scenes. But from what little I know, you know, when Rick took over, he was, even though he came from sort of the head shed, you know, the suits and all that. But when he came in and kind of took over for Gene, you know, he was very much a guardian of what Gene stood for, and that, and again, I'm not an expert, but, you know, he certainly allowed people to push some things, you know, but he kind of was standing at the gate, like, you know, I've been given this property, I'm going to keep a hold of it, I'm going to protect what I think it stood for. And again, I may be kind of talking out my whatever.
No, I think you're right.
At least that's what I'm
because
here.
You look at the show, I mean, there's been many other shows where something like that happens, or a creator leaves. I mean, that's a huge shift in a show run, and for all intents and purposes, Star Trek didn't completely change after Gene's death, which I think is a tribute to Rick Berman.
Yeah, and because I think that's something, and I don't know what the arguments are in Trektum and the debates and all that stuff, but I feel like, I don't get why, the perception is, and maybe I'm wrong, that, like, you know, Rick is like, oh, I don't want to go to Trek conventions because they all hate me. I mean, I know he's kind of emerged in the past year or two. You know, he's on Twitter and actually got tweeted at once, but I'm like, I don't know why anyone hates Rick Berman. I mean, I think you can disagree. I mean, obviously we all have opinions about Trektum, about, you know, Enterprise and DS9 and Voyager and TNG and, you know, what's good, what's bad, blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, you know, I love Star Trek. I love everything that happened. I can critique things, but as far as him, I guess the argument against him is that he was, you know, holding up Gene and he didn't allow people to do what they wanted to do. I'm like, I mean, I'm sure there are more things we could have done to make Next Generation better and DS9 better, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, as far as keeping the philosophy, I'm like, I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, I mean, I see both sides of the argument because, you know, you get into this debate with Star Trek fans and it is a, you know, a lot of people, you know, like to blame everything wrong that, you know, that happened with the Star Trek with Rick Berman, you know, from Gene's death on. And but it's hard to argue the fact that he over...
They don't blame him for his death, do they? That's going too far.
But it's hard to argue completely from that side because he oversaw the entire peak of Star Trek. Like he, you know, I mean, of course he saw, he was still running it when it kind of ran into the ground, unfortunately, which is probably where the frustration comes from. But to be fair, he was there well before that, overseeing it when it was at the highest it's ever been in the mid-90s. So I'm one of those people that thinks, yeah, Rick probably kind of looked at Gene's rules or whatever as you know, religiosity or whatever, and held them up to a ridiculous standard and kind of didn't really see the bigger picture, maybe. But I can't get mad at the guy. I mean, everything I love about Star Trek, not everything, but most of everything that I love about Star Trek was under him. I mean, how do you, you know?
What did he have to do with Kira? That's all Daniel wants to know. Just tweet at him right now. If that was anything to do with Kira, if not,
if that was his decision, I take everything I just said completely back.
Well, you know, we're talking about kind of comparing with other series, and of course, for the TNG show. But as we talk about the philosophy and vision of the Next Generation and the morality, and whatever word you want to use, maybe it's easier to, instead of trying to go from 2013 to the 24th century and, you know, obviously to a made-up future, maybe it's easier if we kind of go for some smaller comparisons. And what if we talk about in this next topic about the jump from the original series to the Next Generation in regards to that vision and to that values, whether you want to look at it as the values of Earthmen and Terrans or the values of Federation or the values of Starfleet. And again, this isn't like, oh, you know, which one's better, TOS or TNG? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, like, you know, just like we can look at the 1960s in America and see the difference between 2013 America. You know, was there a difference in what values or morality or what was important to those Starfleet and Federation people in the original series versus what our intrepid heroes in the Next Generation, the 24th century, were? I mean, you know, the cartoon stereotype was like, oh, in TOS, they just fired phasers and knocked over religions and the Kirk's and had the women, and that was it. And TNG, they just talk them to death all day, you know. But I'm kind of opening it up. So, like, Daniel, do you think that there was kind of can you look at the world and see, like, I can see where some people grew over a few generations, some different minds were opened, or is it kind of like, they're pretty much the same?
No, I don't think they're the same at all. You know, I'll be honest. I'm amazed that, and TOS, you know, please forgive me, fans. I know some people will probably be upset. TOS is by no means my favorite show. I appreciate it.
1 week after Standard Orbit, and I was like, I'm done with them.
I like it, and I appreciate it for what it is. And I say that in basically previewing before I get to the point where I'm going to say that I watch TOS episodes sometimes and I am blown away. I'm like, wow, this is 60s television. This is not something you see often. This is very forward thinking, very impressive, very, you know, very smart people. Clearly were in charge of the show. And this is not the standard of the time as much as I understand it, because clearly I wasn't anywhere around in the 1960s. So, and I think that's the biggest disconnect for me, is that I'm not part of that culture. I don't exist in that world. I can't say whether or not it's an accurate reflection or, but I was born literally a few months before TNG came out. So this speaks much more to me personally, but I can appreciate that quote unquote vision much more in TNG. It makes more sense to me. It seems much more real world to me, much less abstract and silly sometimes. Well, but although sometimes it is, but I think there was like a maturation of ideas between the 60s and the 80s when TNG came out. Like, I think maybe they thought some things through. They got some different writers. I think the 60s is kind of like broad, maybe a little more broad thinking, and these are the big issues, and you know, and then TNG kind of narrows things down a little bit. This is a direct allegory to, you know, whatever. And so maybe that's why it is, but it's probably more the fact that I was born in the 80s. So the show from the 80s would make more sense to me, I guess.
I mean, and let's just try and, I guess I'll just throw some concrete examples, or at least attempt to, you know, and it's, you can argue whether it's just values and morality or just, you know, new ways of thinking, which happens every generation, especially, you know, three or four generations later, you know, 78 years later, or longer. You know, you have the counselor on board by the 24th century, you know, counselors, at least that we know of, you know, we don't know in world when counselors began in Starfleet. And you have sort of that whole philosophy of, you know, in the 24th century, we now have a Klingon on the bridge. We have a former enemy among us now as a friend. In the 23rd century, I mean, everyone was pretty much friendly for the most part in Starfleet. I mean, if you want to get into Enterprise, you could argue Andorians and all that stuff. But at least from what we knew from TOS to TNG, there was that. And there was sort of, and you can argue maybe it was technology, but, you know, Enterprise, the NCC 1701, was sort of like that sardine warship, whereas the Enterprise D was more of a ship of exploration, which the 1701 original was as well, but the D was definitely more, you know, we're interested in science and exploration and ambassadors and diplomats, and arguably maybe because one's bigger than the other, it maybe just has that better feel. But there's sort of that subtle thing of, you know, we're more comfortable in the 24th century, which we've maybe talked about, you know, we've explored more, we've made peace more, we want to kind of cement what we have, whereas in the original series, it's more like everything's new and exploring, and we're kind of still flying by the seat of our pants, you know, sometimes we follow the Prime Directive, sometimes we don't, which again, sometimes we don't follow in the 24th century either.
Yeah.
But like, Darren, what do you think of all this?
Well,
Darren?
I think a big aspect is the captain is really who they're setting the tone for the particular series. And I think to look at the way philosophy is put into practice is really a reflection of Kirk or Picard or Sisko or Janeway. I mean, look at all the moral decisions that Janeway made that we could think of. If Picard was in the chair, you know, probably would have made a very different decision. And, or Kirk, you know, like he was just saying, you know, kind of seat of the pants, cowboy diplomacy, shoot first. And, you know, but with a fierce loyalty to his crew. I mean, Picard admired him and loved, you know, helping him chop wood. But I think he would have made many different command decisions if he had been on the no bloody A, B, C, or D. So I think that's really what it kind of boils down to is, yes, it's different. I mean, the philosophy is always shifting, but I think it really depends on the captain.
You know, having this discussion, like the 23rd versus the 24th century, you know, Kirk versus Picard, these, I do think that these ultimately, and if you want to put it all on Gene, that's okay, because that would make sense too. But this is ultimately, I think what we're seeing is the difference of 20 years. We're seeing the 60s philosophy versus the 80s philosophy. Like, we're seeing the, you know, in the midst, like right in the middle of the Cold War, kind of, you know, all of these kinds of political things going on versus a much more stable world in the 80s, where it's all about comfort and let's have a counselor on the bridge and let's make everyone feel good. Like,
or versus Enterprise, which steps another gap forward.
Yeah. For the post 9/11
world. Exactly. And I do think that all of these, and Philip has mentioned on the show before that, each Star Trek successive Star Trek series is kind of a response to the previous one. So, you know, we do, you know, TOS and then TNG and then TNG and then Deep Space Nine, very, very different. And then Voyager to Deep Space Nine, we kind of go back. And then it's just like, it's each series is definitely very, like, very indicative of the very, very, very environment that it was created in.
And it's sort of the feeling of, as you said, a lot, like I said, we're talking about here about philosophy and morals, and again, which have to be more than just mission statements or conceits or words on paper. They have to be actions. And as you said, Daniel, you know, you look at the people. Yeah, what do the people actually do? You know, because who cares what's on paper? Like, I think the old thing is like, you know, the Soviet Union had a Bill of Rights and a Constitution, but nobody followed it. And, you know, so the same thing here. What are we actually doing here in Starfleet? And so you have Captain Kirk and Captain Picard, and how are they actually living Starfleet? And again, I think you have to judge each, and again, I'm being very in-world, which may be weird to some people. I think you have to judge each man by his time. You know, what was Captain Kirk dealing with the 23rd century, which is different from what Captain Picard was dealing with in the 24th century. You know, you can't, like, it's like comparing, like, General Patton with, like, General Schwarzkopf. I'm like, yeah, that's two different wars. You can't really compare. But yeah, I think it is interesting. I think the best comment would be from, I know we're, like, going from every series in this podcast, would be from Captain Janeway. In the Excelsior episode where she's like, you know, Kirk, Sulu, flashback. You know, McCoy. Yeah. Flashback Voyager. I don't know, Voyager, Photon Torpedo. where she's like, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, like, you know, Kirk was a little too quick with the phaser, a little slower with the prime directive, you know, the whole bunch of them would be drummed out of Starfleet in the 24th century, but, you know, I'd give anything to go back and do all that stuff. You know, the universe was so much bigger back then and all that stuff.
This from the woman that's on the other side of the galaxy.
Well, I know one argument, or at least one thing, and I know Daniel's talked about this, especially in the, I've already forgotten the episode title already, the siege of
AR-5-3-2-8. The siege. Sorry. We'll just call it the siege. Yeah. How's that sound?
Exactly.
Do it three and again, different. We'll do different numbers every time. Again,
we want to keep this TNG based, and so, but like some in that DS9 episode, the argument is like, well, if you take away everything, what do you really like Starfleet? And of course, like, you look at the original series where they were kind of more alone, you know, the Enterprise in the middle of nowhere, you know, they're the only ship in the quadrant. You know, they have to do what they have to do. Whereas TNG, you know, we get to talk to Starfleet. We got the hood, you know, a sector behind us at all times, you know, all that stuff. You know, we got like 1,000 people on the ship. You know, where do you think there were moments in TNG where comfort was sort of stripped away and we were able to see, like, you know, is it just because we're comfortable that we're still can hold to these values? Or do you think there's moments where, yep, we still did it, even though we may not have had all that comfort of that we usually have in TNG?
Wow. That's a great question. A best of both worlds is the thing that pops off in my head. You know, mm-hmm. We see our crew at probably the lowest, I think, that we get to see them, and
he is a Borg.
And I, you know, what a wonderful episode overall, obviously, but we do see their response in the face of adversity, and I think all of the crew responds wonderfully. Like, you know, I mean. And this isn't, and I really don't want to turn this into a TNG versus Deep Space Nine thing, but it's like, if Sisko faced the best of both worlds, he would have killed Picard, I think, instantly. Like,
Daniel. He was there at World 3-5.
Right. But you know what I'm saying? And that's like the big contention, right, between Deep Space Nine fans and TNG fans is like something like In the Pale Moonlight, where Sisko does what he needs to get it done. And I love Sisko and I love Deep Space Nine. So I'm not trying to say which is better, but I do want to say that there is a difference. And
now, Daniel, I don't know if you've heard the end of our podcast, but Riker actually tries to kill Picard at the end of every
No, I understand that. But what I'm saying is that if Picard was on the ship, I don't think it would have been an option for Sisko. Sisko would have, they would never have attempted a rescue mission, is my point, I suppose. But our TNG people, who we are saying are much more optimistic, they're still going to go out on that limb. They're still going to try to do what it takes. They're, you know what I'm saying? Like, it is a bit more positive, I think. And that is maybe a little bit of it. But again, this is not a TNG versus Deep Space Nine thing. It's just a Star Trek thing. And it's like, TNG does get that right. I think, like I said, Best of Both Worlds, the lowest we see our characters. And I think they don't lose themselves. They don't lose that core philosophy. They all try to maintain themselves above the situation.
I think a great episode where, you know, they're put in a much different situation. It's not so much in the area of attack is Chain of Command, and their entire family is basically almost kind of uprooted. I mean, Picard's keeping secrets about that portion of the mission. You have a new commanding officer that comes in that just kind of shakes everything up. And that's where, I mean, look at Riker. I mean, Riker is kind of, he's a Reed, and he's bent very, very strongly in that, you know, he really doesn't seem to like Jellicoe, but he does his job. And we've seen him only in the Picard days, where Picard just thinks he's the greatest officer since sliced bread, you know, and can do no wrong and sit down in the captain's chair, Will, you know. So I think in that episode, it's great in displaying, like we're talking about, the instances where the crew is put to the test, and they don't have all the, in this regard, they don't have all the comfort of their family, where they're like, oh, well, we're really a family. We're serving together, and yes, we have a chain of command, but, you know, I know Picard's got my back, or I know the captain would act this way. With Jellicoe, it's a blank slate, and they really have to react to, you know, well, what does he mean when he says this? What is he, you know, oh, he's putting me in a uniform. Oh, he's taking away Livingston. It's like everything's changing, you know, so.
Which is why we never saw him again.
Yeah, we never saw him.
You know, I think, Daniel, to go back to your point, and I'm thinking about it because, and again, I'm not trying to get too deep here, but especially when you look at Enterprise, and again, not that we're comparing to everything.
But we are.
But yeah, you know, where are we at our most vulnerable, or you know, where the truth hits the road, or whatever the saying is, the rubber hits the road, you know, when we're most exposed, you know, are we really who we say we are, or who are we? So the Borg, perfect example. I think Best of Both Worlds is great. You know, we're at the brink of destruction. How are we going to go out? Another example would be I, Borg, okay? Again, we're faced with this mortal enemy who could destroy our way of life, you know. And does that mean that we throw the rules out the window and just say, look, we need to preserve the way we are, and we can't have these rules and regulations? And so when you have Captain Picard, who's faced with, do I use the virus, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, I'm probably using the wrong terminology, do I use that virus to destroy the Borg?
I mean, basically commit genocide. You know, it's like us, yeah, or them. Are we really, is it really that black and white?
Because then you have Chayef chewing him out and Descent? Where she chews him out later and says, look, if you ever have that opportunity, you take it, because you blew it last time. And so, some would say, you know, well, of course Picard should take out the Borg. They're a mortal threat. I don't care if they're cute and we name them. You know, it's like naming your chicken before you kill it and fry it, right?
Like Data, don't give it a name. Oh, Data, you gave it a name.
Exactly.
No, but that is so brilliant, Philip, because you're absolutely right. And I'm not even gonna just pick out Sisko here. I'm gonna say Picard is the only captain I think that would have done that. I think he's the only one that would have realized. I think Kirk definitely would have. I definitely think Sisko would have. I think Janeway and even Archer would. We see all of these captains get to a similar point in their careers where they have to make this heavy decision, and a lot of them choose otherwise. They decide that, hey, you know, there's a lot of parallels anyways between the captains. And I do think that Picard himself is a very direct reflection of TNG's philosophy. Like, I think he is the ultimate this is the next generation idea wrapped in a man. And you know what I mean? And while he is flawed, he is very much larger than life. And we had a whole, you should guys, the listener should go back and listen to our Picard episode, because we've talked about this, but you know, we get to
make it so
we get this man who like you said, an Iborg. I mean, there is no person in the universe that has suffered more from the Borg than Picard has. And he still overcomes that prejudice and that bigotry and that racism. And he says, no, we're not doing this. This is not what we do. This is not what humanity does anymore. And I think that's why I love TNG. And I think that's just the most brilliant, brilliant, brilliant example. And good job, Philip.
Well, thank you. And I think there's a lot more to say about the issues of war. You know, the complaint is, you know, we didn't see war per se. I mean, we saw conflict in Next Generation. We had the Cardassian War, which is kind of off screen, apparently, during the first 4 to 5 seasons. And, you know, the Romulans and you know, we were at war, though not really as compared to the Dominion War in Deep Space Nine. And we can have argue about what, you know, the ghost of Gene may have not wanted war in as a storyline. But anyway, I kind of want to pivot, even though I'm sure we could talk about war for a whole other podcast.
Ooh,
and just talk about some other...
not the next generation.
Matt Rushing already beat you to that reference. So, and I just want to talk about two quick moments, and I'm kind of opening it up to any other kind of moments that you think we need to be mentioned about, you know, a moment or an episode or someone who really displays what it means about the philosophy of Next Generation. Two quick ones. Darren already mentioned it, but I'm just going to repeat it again because he stole it because it was so good. First duty. So you have Picard making that speech, which Darren already gave, but I just kind of want to say that sentence one more time about what Picard says is that the first duty of a Starfleet officer is to the truth. And again, you know, not to get very, you know, Pontius Pilate and the Gospels and whatever, you know, what is truth? Is there, you know, but anyway, what Picard defines it. Okay, well, what's truth? He says, whether it's a scientific truth, a historical truth, or personal truth, he says, that is the guiding principle upon which Starfleet is based, which is crazy. I mean, in a good way to me. I mean, that's really, you know, we think about our armed forces and, you know, which is about, you know, fighting and defend, you know, fighting and winning the nation's wars. I mean, that's it. That's what we do in the United States Armed Forces. But that Starfleet is about truth. It's about scientific truth. It's about historical truth. It's about personal truth, whatever that means. And that's what Starfleet is. I mean, I don't know if you all would agree that's what we see on screen, but that's crazy that it basically says, like, you know, we don't care. We may be proved wrong in what we do, but we're out to find the truth. And sometimes we may not like the truth, but we'll just have to accept it as we do our missions, about whether it's science, whether it's about history, whether it's about who we are as humanity. And I mean, to me, like, you know, if I ever got another tattoo, because I already have one of the Federation of Planets logo, that would be that phrase that of what Picard says, because I think it's so crazy powerful in those however many words that it is, 20 words or something or less. So, like, that's crazy. You could do teach a whole year on that phrase alone.
I mean, exactly. And honestly, when we were bringing up this point, I did want to bring up the, and this might be a little unfair, but the encounter at Farpoint / All Good Things trial, which, you know, encounter doesn't do many things right, but that trial is brilliant, and it really sets the tone for the rest of the show, and then of course in All Good Things is wrapped up completely perfectly. And go ahead.
No, I mean, I don't want to steal your thunder, but I love what you're saying, because this is the capstone of Next Generation. That, you know, Picard says, I hope I never find myself here. And Q's like, you just don't get it, do you? The trial never ends. We never reached it. And that's it. That the trial of humanity, are we a dangerous, savage child race, or are we something more? The trial never ends. And again, I hate to be so lofty and, you know, hippy drippy here on this episode, but I mean, that's to me, that's the Next Generation. Who are we as humanity? And we're still discovering each and every day. So again, but Darren, what are some episodes or moments to you that kind of display things?
I think some we've mentioned before, with the drumhead and that amazing speech by Picard. Obviously, you can't get through a philosophy discussion without talking about Measure of a Man. pretty much can't get through a podcast without talking about Measure of Man in some regard. But, you know, you have this great moral play on, you know, what is life? What is, you know, humanity? And, you know, that also comes into play with The Offspring when Data creates Lal. And, you know, does how much power does the state have? You know, you get all these great, you know, again, bits of philosophy thrown in. And I think maybe that's one of the, you know, to my point earlier about the captain setting the tone. I mean, Picard is much more of a philosopher than any other captain. I mean, he reads. He has so many pads, all with different books on them, you know, to read through. And I think, you know, it's just such a encapsulating aspect of his character, and really sets the tone for the series as he, you know, and many times will choose to stick with the truth and stick with his orders. You know, there's very rarely where he'll throw his orders out the window, except for movie Picard, but, you know, that's another story. But, but like the episode where he's dealing with the Sheliak, you know, he doesn't fight them. He doesn't say, I'm the flagship. I have 42 freaking decks. This thing is a beast. I'm going to take you out. It's like, no, he's like, I'm going to find that sub paragraph that gives me, you know, my in, and uses it flawlessly. So, you know, yeah.
And dust the dedication plaque while he's at it.
Exactly. You're talking about quotes, and, and I'm wondering if maybe there's a little hidden extra bit on that dedication plaque. We, you know, with all of Picard's, that's where he pulls all of his speechisms from.
Well, and I want to give Daniel one more chance because I feel like I cut him off with the trial there. But one thing I do want to do, because y'all...
We never cut off Daniel. I don't know what you're talking about.
Wait, what?
One thing I do...
Oh, God. No,
one
God.
Last moment is that, because y'all beat me up about it constantly, Insurrection. Come on. That speech in Star Trek Insurrection. How many people does it take, Admiral, before it becomes wrong?
Oh, yeah.
100?
1,000?
500? 1,000? A million? How many people does it take, Admiral? Because I think, oh, that was my moment in Insurrection. Like, yes, Picard speech for the win. You know, because, and again, you can argue about the episode or the movie or whatever, but I'm like, again, the moral question. I mean, I love that, like, forcing it. What are we talking about? What's going on? What are we looking inside ourselves? It's not just firing phasers and photon torpedoes and who can we shoot and what ship is better. It's who we are, what's going on, and what's the truth. So, Daniel, you know, anything else you want to say as far as episodes or moments? I'm sure you want to bring up something from Nemesis.
No. I will concede that the moment that you mentioned from Insurrection is, it's definitely the best part of the film, I think. You know, but Picard, he's the best at these, like, kind of self-righteous, sanctimonious speeches, but he's always right. So, I mean, you can see that why people might, like, be frustrated or irritated or whatever, but... Or maybe turned off by it, but it's like, we love it. We TNGers love it because we know he as a character, even though he's larger than life, he is the ideal. He's the TNG ideal of he's more reflective of the quote unquote Roddenberry vision than Kirk ever was. Not that there's anything wrong with Kirk. It's just he lives in a different world. But the reason I brought up the whole encounter trial / all good things trial is because I think that completely is representative of TNG as a whole, and it's a brilliant little piece that they brought into the first episode, and I loved how they finished it out. And it's just like, yeah, humanity has this past and humanity has these issues, but ultimately we are better than that. We are better than the sum of our parts. So,
all right, thanks, Daniel. For the last topic here, and I know we're kind of going here, how realistic is this vision? You know, we've talked about the Roddenberry vision or the optimistic vision and the philosophy, but, like, how realistic is it? You know, both Darren and Daniel have talked about the fact that, you know, here in the 21st century, most of what we see in sci-fi is dystopian, you know, whether it's zombies or whether it's, you know, aliens invading, or whether it's all that, you know, bad future, apocalyptic, you know, whatever, giant monsters fighting with giant robots, you know, which is cool. I'm not going to say it's not cool, but all these visions we get that's very, you know, negative. And Star Trek, whether it represented that 60s, you know, revolutionary counterculture spirit that continued into the 80s, optimism. You know, but is it realistic? And I'm going to give a quick blurb here and let you all talk. You know, one thing that I was kind of looking forward to in Enterprise was, okay, how do we get from, you know, World War III, what we saw in Counter at Farpoint, right? What we saw at the afterwards in World War III, you know, no governments, you know, First Contact too, you know, no governments, no resistance, you know, to what we see in TOS and beyond. And so Enterprise, you had this prequel experience, but like, it must have like happened, it was almost like this 50-year like magic period of like, you know, between First Contact and like, you know, Enterprise. Like, oh, we fixed everything. I'm like, how'd you fix everything? It's like only been like 50 years. I thought it was going to take a little bit longer than this. You know, because if you look at that time period, everything kind of magically fixes itself pretty fast there. But, you know, I would say that, though, for people who are like, oh, no, the future's never going to be that perfect. People are always going to be terrible. You know, Babylon 5 and Battlestar Galactica, that's how people are going to be. We're not going to change that much. But, like, the way Star Trek would explain it is, in my opinion, you can say I'm wrong, is that it took a world war, like the nuclear decimation, just basically start from zero, and that's how we rebuilt ourselves. And, you know, First Contact and the whole speech in Star Trek First Contact about how we all came together. But, like, that's what it took in Star Trek. According to Star Trek, that's how we all got to a unified utopia, is that we just destroyed everything and started all over from zero. Well, here in 2013, I certainly hope that doesn't happen in real life. You know, I hope we don't have billions of people die and we have to start from zero. I somehow hope we can, you know, go from where we are now. So, but let me open it up. Daniel, you know, that 24th century vision, is that something that you think can happen in by the real 24th century? Or do you think it might take a little bit longer than that until that 29th century when we get the mobile holographic emitter?
Wow, that is a tough question. Undoubtedly, I fall on the side of yes. This is what I want. This is what I think will happen. I actually, without getting too far into it, I do think as a species we're probably heading towards one of two possibilities, where World War III is actually one of the possibilities, and continued existence is the other. So, you know, I hope it's not going to take that world war for us to learn our lessons, because it's tough to see a scenario in which anybody comes out of that okay. But, you know, you do mention that there is a 50-year span of time between what we know would happen in World War III and First Contact or beyond, how we fix everything. And I do think that maybe, and I hope it's not true. I don't want it to be true. I don't know. I am optimistic. It's hard for me to say, because we're talking about optimism in Star Trek. And I think a lot of the reason that I'm optimistic about the future is because of Star Trek. So it's hard for me to say if I'm optimistic of the future without it. It's kind of circular. So I hope that we can achieve it. I think that things are getting better, despite a lot of people's views of looking at the world. And I think that things will continue to get better. And I think as long as people try to make things better, and as long as, you know, we're heading in the direction we're heading, I actually think we're going to be okay. I think it's definitely possible. I'm going to say that. Yeah.
All right. Thumbs up from Daniel. What about you, Darren? Is this vision realistic, or is it just a crazy former World War II pilot's crazy imagination?
No, I'd like to think it's possible. I do think that, you know, get to the half question there of what could have caused that shift. I think that World War III is probably the largest factor, not necessarily for the reasoning of how many people died, but more because of, I think, one of the largest factors. And if you look at it on a macro level of society, one of the largest factors in the continuation of suffering and of hate and of things like that is it being passed on from generation to generation. And you have generations that are taught, oh, well, we don't associate with these kinds of people, or we don't like this group. And if you have this world war, that's the way I kind of see it going down, is, okay, you wipe out 2/3 of the population, and literally everyone who's left is just like, forget it. There's not enough time to fight over these things, but also there's no one to teach the next generation on who to hate because they're all gone. You know, they've been fighting. So again, that's just, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me, like that it could be something along those lines that causes this change, or at least kicks it forward into something that could happen in 50 years instead of, you know, several generations. But yeah, I think I have the same kind of circular logic as Daniel, as man, as a fallen being, that, you know, the hardest part to get by is the whole, you know, you're basically asking humanity to change human nature, which is very, very difficult to do. But I think that doesn't preclude us to imagining and believing and trying to change. I think once you stop trying to change humanity to something better, to a vision like that, then you've kind of missed the point, and you're definitely heading down that fork in the road where we're going to hit, you know, a dystopian society. So that's the way I look at it. And I believe, you know, that, yeah, since Star Trek has inspired me to look towards that future, that is our future. It can be our future. We can use technology. We can overcome these, you know, what will seem like petty things, you know, in the future. And hopefully we'll be wise enough to pass on better knowledge to our children.
It reminds me, and I don't know why we can only find not the best quality episodes to prove our points, but it reminds me of, and I'm blanking on the name, the second Q episode with Riker, where Picard is quoting Hamlet to Q, that's not off the top of my head, I'm not even going to try, but where Hamlet is basically being sarcastic about humanity. Oh yeah, look at man.
What a piece of work man is.
Exactly. Yeah. But where Picard says, look, where Hamlet is being sarcastic, I'm being truthful. And Q's like, are you kidding? That's really what you think humanity is? You must be ridiculous. Picard says, well, no, but I think that's what we can be and what we will be. And you know, again, not to be cheesy, but the quote, I think, and I'm probably going to mess it up, the quote from Martin Luther King is that the moral arc of history bends towards justice, and that, you know, that's where we're at least hoping, that's where we can go. And, you know, it may take us a while to get there, whether, you know, in whatever category you want to talk about. But that's kind of where we're going. So I agree with all two of you that we have drunk the synth Kool-Aid when it comes to Star Trek.
Can't use that title. That, we already used it.
We copyrighted it ourselves. So anyway. But it's been interesting talking about the vision and the philosophy of the next generation today. But this is just one of the many topics we've been talking about on Trek.fm this week. Here's a quick look at what else you may have missed on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
The unmade Starfleet Academy movie.
You know, even on paper. Okay, do we want to do the script, which was written by the guy who wrote Star Trek V, or do we want to do the script, which was written by the guy who wrote Star Trek II?
Earl Grey.
The ships of TNG.
Oh, no, it's one ship that splits into three parts, just like the D is one ship that splits into two parts. It's not a Voltron, it's one ship.
An owl formed the saucer.
The orb.
Dr. Bashir, I presume, commentary.
I know, it's just awesome. The look on Sisko's face the whole time, he's just looking at Zimmerman like, all right, you're a piece of work, aren't you?
Exactly.
To the journey!
Sisko.
And obviously, Sisko couldn't let go.
No.
And she proved that by having his child against his will.
Yeah. Now, here is the Maury Show twist of the future. He does not impregnate her. She impregnates herself with his DNA, or so she thought. But he is not the father.
The ready room.
The ship.
But it's also really gloomy, and it's sad. I never want to go back there. I don't want to, like, re-experience that. Like, just the visual candy of being able to go outside and talk to the Vorta and... Wow, I maybe didn't phrase that properly. I meant the change in color and lighting.
Oh.
I did not mean, but she's a very
I thought you were
Vorta.
Talking about Kiana.
She is fetching. No? She's a fetching lass.
Warp 5.
Zindi Evolution.
Well, I think maybe Okapa and Insectoid are two races that could have a life together. You know, you've got the 9-year lifespan of the Okapa. You've got the 12-year lifespan of an Insectoid. If they meet at the right time, it could be a beautiful love story.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Ira Steven Bear's Star Trek.
And it's the first time I heard him say something that he said several times over the years is, you know, one day when we're not the middle child, we're not the stepchild, people are going to go, holy crap, look at DS9.
Literary Treks.
Slings and Arrows, A Sea of Troubles.
You see in this book, too, that Picard is facing this melancholy because they've been worried about the Borg, and now the Dominion is on the horizon, and there's these two things, and obviously this is before First Contact, so that hasn't happened yet. And Picard seems to be kind of weighed down in this story in some ways.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and get in on the daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can stream and download files from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. Now, if you'd like to share your thoughts on today's Earl Grey, if you agree or disagree with what we've said here, just go to trek.fm/contact, and there's a form there. You can choose to send a show option and choose Earl Grey, and that message will come to all three of us by email. You can also use the tab on the right-hand side of any page to send us a voicemail using your webcam's microphone, and we'd love for you to be the first voicemail we receive in 2014. You can talk to us and other listeners in our forums at trek.fm/forums, and in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and on Twitter under username trekfm. And also, while you're making those New Year's resolutions, why not make one of those resolutions to leave us an iTunes review? That'd be a great way to start off the 2014. By leaving an iTunes review, that will help other listeners find our show and help ensure Earl Grey a prosperous 2014. So, Daniel, if the listeners want to wish you a happy 2014, where can they find you on the interwebs?
They can find me on Twitter. It's the easiest way to do it. It would be at OneUpDan. That is the number one, not the word.
And Darren, if the listeners want to thank you for all you've done here editing Earl Grey in 2013, where can listeners find you on the interwebs?
Well, in 2013, you could find me at Dr. Sci-Fi, but in 2014, you'll find me at Dr. Sci-Fi. That's D-R-S-C-I-F-I. Still Dr. Sci-Fi, not changing for the new year, but I do have some other resolutions. But you can also join me on my website, which is drsci-fi.com.
And you can find me and tell me whether or not I talk too much about the wonderful world of philosophy on the internet, on Twitter, at NC Public Servant. That's NC like North Carolina. And before we close out our last show of 2013, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsor, who makes it possible for us to bring Earl Grey and other shows to you each week. Audible.com is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read, but never thought you'd have the time for. I mean, Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers, Audible has something for everyone. There are many next-generation books available on Audible, including two books which I have both read and would be excited to actually listen to being read. One is The Devil's Heart, read by Gates McFadden, Dr. Beverly herself, and Q in Law, read by both John DeLancey and Majel Barrett, because they Q in Law walks on a story. Very good. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today and catch up on all those classic books you've yet to read or that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank you and Audible for supporting Earl Grey and Trek.fm. Also, you can help us continue to bring Earl Grey to you in 2014 each week by getting your alien badges and art prints featuring original illustrations by Toba Ushi. You'll find them at trek.fm/donate, and your support helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the show to you each week. So thanks, everyone, for listening. I'm off to ignore my family for the holidays and instead watch some great Next Generation episodes. So on behalf of Daniel and Darren, we here at Earl Grey wish you a Merry Trexmas and a Happy New Year. Make it so.
Engage.
Live long and prosper.
Fire.